Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Naked Feminism, Breaking the Cult of Female Modesty by Victoria Bateman. Narrated by Victoria Bateman. Publisher's note. This audiobook contains references to visuals present in the print and ebook editions of the book. For all women. Modest or otherwise. Acknowledgements. This book is personal and political. It fuses academic work with the experience of placing my own naked body in the public sphere. It provides a response to all those who've questioned whether being naked can be feminist. And it's a reaction to the numerous times I've been called trashy, a whore, and an idiot. It tells the story of when, how, and why societies became obsessed with women's bodily modesty, whether their virginity or their state of dress, and explores the many adverse consequences that have resulted. It lifts the lid on the battle that has long taken place within feminism, between those who regard modesty as a necessary tool of liberation and those, like me, who argue that a woman's respect and worth shouldn't depend on something as superficial as either her state of dress or whether her hymen is intact. Much of the book was inspired by observation, observing the way scantily clad women, as well as those dressing modestly, are stereotyped, observing the way strippers and sex workers are disparaged and talked down to, and observing the way people reacted with judgment towards my own naked endeavours. Throughout the associated judgment, I have been extremely fortunate to have received support from friends and colleagues, including Ruth Skerr, Karenjeet Clare, Carolina Alves, Clive Lawson, Lucy Delap, Michelle Badley, Avna Offer, Arif Ahmed, Alan Fersht, and Natasha Devon, along with my sister, Stephanie. I have benefited not only from the published work, but also the camaraderie of Deborah Oxley, Emma Rees, Bina Agarwal, Keon West, Philippa Levine, Kate Lister, Erin Hengel, and Belinda Brooks Gordon. All of these and so many more deserve a big thank you. I have also been touched by the support offered to me by those who've reached out online and by post and have been forever moved by the kindness offered by both the sex worker and the nudist communities. Polity Press deserves a particular thank you, most notably my editor, Louise Knight, along with Innes Boxman, Emma Longstaff, Susan Beer, Anne Sullivan, Emma Nash, Jim Caunter, George Hours, and Pascal Porcheron, and two anonymous readers who offered not only helpful suggestions, but also support when the project was in its first stages. Emma Rees read the full manuscript in great detail and injected punch into the final stage of the project, for which I'm very grateful. The unfailing and unconditional love of my husband of 17 years and counting is something I never take for granted and goes to show that immodest women can and should be treated with love and respect. Preface. This book isn't a feminist manifesto for nudity, even though I would happily write one. and it isn't an invitation for every listener to strip layer by layer with each passing chapter, though I certainly have no objection if you do so. Its aim is broader, to place in full view what I call the cult of female modesty. The way in which, in many societies across the world, a woman's worth, value, and respect depend on her bodily modesty. It draws not only on the personal, the private and public criticism I've received for my own acts of bodily immodesty, but also on the experiences of women who face a much tougher culture of modesty, from forced veiling to virginity testing and honour killings. As I hope will be clear, my objection is not to modesty in the sense of what people wear or how they choose to live their sex lives, but instead to societal attitudes, to those who think that women's uncovered or promiscuous bodies are the problem, and who in turn deem immodest women a threat to themselves, a danger to other women, and a disruptive force in wider society. Challenging the modesty cult doesn't therefore mean that we should all shed our veils or bikini tops. It means that we should respect modest and immodest women alike, resting a woman's value and respect on much more important things than bodily modesty. Throughout, I reflect on how modesty culture is affecting women's lives today, and consider how the past has shaped the present. To provide vital perspective, Chapter 1 offers some historical background, revealing the way in which the modesty cult is deeply rooted not only in the Middle East, but also in South Asia, the Far East, and parts of Europe. While not all world regions have historically been as tightly within its grip, including parts of Australasia, Southeast Asia, Western and Southern Africa, and the Americas, we'll see how colonisation, international trade, and religion acted to spread the cult of female modesty into these areas, with serious consequences for women. For the sake of brevity, our historical journey is necessarily a speedy one, meaning that my focus is on covering major trends across large geographical areas, rather than providing detailed analysis of an individual society or a specific period. And precisely because modesty culture is multifaceted, I try to give a taste of not only clothing customs, but also attitudes to women's sexual activity, including those towards the most immodest of all women, sex workers. Since my focus is on breadth, for a listener who has more time to explore history in greater depth, I would recommend Philip Cargom's A Brief History of Nakedness, Ruth Barkun's Nudity, A Cultural Anatomy, Annabella Pollan's Nudism in a Cold Climate, Hanny Blank's Virgin, The Untouched History, Kate Lister's Harlots, Whores and Hackabouts, Ruth Mazzo Karras's Common Women, Emma Reese's The Vagina, A Literary and Cultural History, Stephanie Cronin's Anti-Veiling Campaigns in the Muslim World, Nikki Keddie's Women in the Middle East, Barbara Maloney et al.'s Gender in Modern East Asia, and Faramir's Dabiola's The Origins of Sex, amongst many other books. Much of this book is what could be defined as heteronormative. It discusses policies and practices that are constructed on the assumption that men are attracted to women who are in turn attracted to men. This is because the modesty cult itself is predicated on heteronormative assumptions that we are cisgendered and heterosexual. The feminist critics of immodest women, who we similarly encounter in this book, also tend to deploy their armoury, including concepts such as the male gaze and objectification, in a heteronormative way. As the journalist Zoe Williams points out, the rhetoric of objectification relies on the idea that it's one-way traffic, that only men objectify and only women are objectified. Since I do not support the modesty cult, it may not come as a surprise that I also do not support the explicit or otherwise homophobia and transphobia that almost without exception accompanies it. As becomes clear in the course of this book, women can themselves be complicit in the cult of female modesty, judging and looking down on those who are either insufficiently covered or deemed sexually promiscuous. Why this is the case, and whether modesty culture is truly in women's collective best interest, is the topic of Chapter 4. With it, I consider numerous strands of feminist thought, including the feminism of the suffragettes, socialist feminism, Islamic feminism, and radical feminism, to uncover the degree to which they do or do not embrace aspects of the modesty cult. The lines are rarely either clear-cut or consistent. Some feminists reject naked protest, while others support protesting naked but oppose glamour modelling. Similarly, some feminists question casual sex, while others view it as a sign of liberation but condemn those who sell sex. And some object to compulsory hijab abroad, while also disapproving of short skirts and revealing tops at home, ironically using the same logic as those imposing the compulsory hijab. It is certainly common for people to pick and choose, approving or being tolerant of some behaviours which could be deemed immodest, but not others. For example, life models are commonly seen as more acceptable than glamour models. Women who have premarital sex in a long-term relationship are typically seen as more respectable than those who also engage in casual sex. Strippers are often judged less disapprovingly than women who have sex for money, and women who have lots of casual sex are judged much more favourably than those who choose to sell sex. I frequently, however, find myself questioning the divisions that are commonly constructed in our minds between different aspects of immodesty. For example, if I was ever to be paid for delivering a naked performance on the topic of feminism, would that have any overlap with stripping? If a life model sells naked images of herself to artists for artistic purposes. Does what she's doing have any degree of overlap with glamour modelling? After all, some of her images may well be bought for pornographic use. If you model underwear for a high street chain, is there any overlap with posing for a lad's mag? While there are certainly differences between each of these activities, which many are of course keen to point out, there is also some degree of commonality, and acknowledging that is, I believe, vital to breaking down the divisions between women. The feminist Robin Morgan worried that, to quote, the erosion of the virgin whore stereotype would erase the last vestige of even corrupted respect for women. But surely we can build respect for women on the basis of something other than bodily modesty. Rather than erecting a wall between women, we can and should be setting a wrecking ball loose on the very idea of division. If we truly object to the modesty culture that drives compulsory hijab, virginity testing, and honour killings, we shouldn't be slut-shaming scantily clad women and stigmatising glamour models, strippers, or sex workers. By breaking the cult of female modesty, we have the power to solve a whole host of problems that plague women's lives across the world. Problems that have so far proved intractable. Our ultimate aim must be to ensure that every woman is respected and valued, irrespective of her state of bodily coverage or the degree to which her hymen is intact. Introduction. What determines a woman's worth? Is it her achievements, her personality, her beliefs? Is it her conscientiousness, her open-mindedness, how kind and generous she is to others? Or is it what she shows or doesn't show of her body that determines whether a woman is valued and respected by society? I pose these questions not only as a woman, but also as a naked feminist, someone who views my body alongside my brain as a means of advancing feminism. Rather than being afraid of the female body and keen to repress femininity and sexuality, naked feminists respect those who make use of their body, their brain, or both. As someone who has, among other things, delivered public lectures, attended a Royal Economic Society gala, and appeared on national television, all while wearing no more than shoes and a smile, albeit accompanied by my trusty handbag, there is little doubting my commitment to the naked feminist cause. Yet not everyone agrees with my approach. The following are a select few of the many thousands of comments I've received. Good God, she single-handedly took feminism back to the Stone Age. There's nothing more anti-feminist than having to strip naked, desperate for a man's attention. A woman's body is a work of art, a gift from God to man. My wife would wholeheartedly disagree with you on flaunting it for this purpose. Thanks for sullying the sanctity of women whose bodies are private to them and their significant other. Being trashy is never classy, and you certainly are quite trashy. You're a disgrace to all women. One person even reported me via Twitter to the Cambridge Police Department. Unfortunately for them, they were foiled by their poor understanding of geography. As they discovered, the Cambridge Police Department in Massachusetts has no jurisdiction over Cambridge, England. Not that I had, in fact, committed any crime. You might, of course, be questioning why it matters if I receive a torrent of abuse for revealing my body. After all, haven't I asked for it with my actions? Don't I deserve my comeuppance? Yet it's this asking for it mentality that sometimes, on a more subconscious level, pervades so much of society's attitude towards women. Explicitly or implicitly, and inside as well as outside feminism, women's respect still hangs on their bodily modesty, on the degree to which their body is unseen and untouched. As a result, crimes and inappropriate behaviour committed against what society judges to be immodest women are trivialised, with women who show off their bodies, along with those who are deemed promiscuous, being seen as fair game and deserving of punishment. By imposing bodily modesty as a perceived virtue on women, society actively prevents the equality of the sexes. In other words, what I will call the cult of female modesty, the belief that a woman's worth, value, and respect depend on her bodily modesty, inhibits equality rather than furthering the cause of women. As we will see, this modesty cult not only shuns and devalues the women it categorises as whores, it hurts all women, modest as well as immodest. No one escapes its wrath. In some countries, the modesty cult couldn't be more clear. In Egypt, Morocco, and Palestine, more than 8 in 10 men think that their honour depends on how their female relatives dress and behave, and more than a third think that the victims of honour killings usually deserve such punishment. A study of male preferences in regard to female partners found that sexual inexperience was valued highly by men in Indonesia, Iran, India, China, and Taiwan. Measured in terms of attitudes to virginity, Indonesia, Jordan, Pakistan, Palestine, Turkey, and Egypt, where 90% or more of people consider premarital sex unacceptable, would surely top any modesty ranking. Other countries that also display high levels of disapproval of premarital sex include Nigeria at 77%, India at 67%, and China at 58%. As Tang et al. Write, nowadays, Chinese people typically hold more open and positive attitudes towards sex than in previous decades, but its citizens are still not as open as Westerners. In the West, the proportion of people who deem premarital sex unacceptable stands at 30% in the United States, a mere 13% in the UK, and only 6% in France and Germany, which rank as the most promiscuous or least judgmental of all countries. Attitudes towards birth control, which capture the degree to which people think that sex can and should be divorced from reproduction, also help us to reveal where the modesty cult is most apparent. The countries that rank highest in these terms are Pakistan, where 65% find birth control unacceptable, Nigeria at 54%, Ghana at 52%, and Malaysia at 40%. In the United States, only 7% of people take the view that birth control is morally unacceptable. In the UK, it's even lower at 3%, and in Germany, it's a mere 1%. But on a personal level, the reaction that I faced to my naked feminism has made clear to me that even in supposedly liberal countries, too many of us still judge women based on their bodily modesty. Delving deeper into embedded societal attitudes and behaviours only confirms this fact, and worryingly, the evidence is that modesty culture is now on the rise. And this is why I'm writing this book. I want to explore the history of female modesty, to examine the situations of the women whose lives are most blighted by the modesty cult today, to bring to light the way in which modesty culture is gathering steam, and to raise the alarm as to what lies ahead. I want to make clear that the modern-day modesty resurgence isn't only associated with clerics, conservatives, and nationalists. It's also at risk of polluting feminism itself, particularly as we react to the issues raised by the ubiquitous presence of sex and women's bodies in today's striptease culture. I end with a plea to all my fellow feminists and liberals, a plea to reject rather than to embrace the modesty cult. While today's raunch culture might be far from perfect, we should be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. As we will hear, the modesty cult cannot be our saviour. For too long, and in too many places, the cult of female modesty has gone under the radar. And that's in large part because modesty culture possesses a secret weapon. It is exceptionally evasive. The line between modesty and immodesty is drawn in a different place, in different time periods, and in different societies. What one person judges to be modest, another might judge to be immodest, depending on where they live and in which century. In parts of the Middle East, a woman without a headscarf is considered naked, whereas a European woman wearing a bikini wouldn't in general be described as such. Indeed, as Monique Mulholland notes in her book Negotiating Pornification, a scantily clad woman can still be considered respectable in Western culture so long as she behaves in a controlled way in terms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?